$7,000. And I told my wife earlier, I just hate speaking here tonight. because it's in front of your friends, you know what I mean? It's just easier to speak to people you don't know. Frank Hendricks, Frank would share that. He couldn't stand speaking. He spoke a lot. He just couldn't stand it. And I couldn't figure out why. And then I spoke a couple times. I figured out why. Because I'd speak and think about it for 3 days, 4 days. And just nobody else was, but I'm thinking about it because I'm never good enough. I'm never enough. I think maybe once when I was new speaking, I'd been about 7 years sober, and I got to speak a few times, and I thought it's really unspiritual to listen to your humility, right? And then I heard this famous speaker who spoke all over that she'd listened to her tape. A good friend of mine said, oh, yeah, she listened to her tape so she can give a better pitch. So I thought, well, she does it. So I thought, I felt like a movie star going to watch his own movie, you know what I mean? So I put this tape in. Oh, I didn't like it. I thought, oh, my God, it's worse than I thought, you know what I mean? But I had about 6 or 7, and then I found one, and I thought, God, it really was good, you know, and my. And so I thought, well, I listened to it one more time, and then that's it, because I felt it would be so vain and self-centered to listen to myself more than once, but I said, one more time. So this is for you newcomers. This is alcoholism. I listened to it one more time, and then it was on. Boom. Third time, fourth time, fifth time. Bad mood, put that tape on. Then my wife got in my car one day. I threw it under the seat. I went over to the seat. I was listening to myself talk. And I went, and I was the main speaker. And during the break, a lot of old-timers were there. And halfway after the break, about half of them left the meeting. And so these were people I knew for a long time. So I'm like, I'm wiped out. I'm just like, took the wind out of my sails. I thought, you know, I'm so self-centered. I think it's all about me. I didn't realize every week they come there to visit people and leave at the break. I just think, well, even if they did, if I was speaking, of course they would stay. You know how what I mean? And then I got up to speak, and I couldn't even speak. And I just busted myself. I can't even talk tonight. I felt like I got a movie star memorizing his lines for a movie. And I thought, so I stopped doing that. But I'm grateful to be here. I love the people here. It was Craig and Ron and Willie. Willie does a lot of work in AA over at the men's house. And good to see you. We've had some interesting discussions about trying to get some guys in there. Trying to shade the truth so they get by Willie. As long as you get through the get in the door, we'll work it out later. And got that from Bill Hennicutt, though, so it can't be all bad. Anyway, I love being here. I love being sober. It's an honor and privilege to be here. Sounds very shallow and not like I mean it, but I mean it from the bottom of my heart. I got a call from Ron Taylor today, asked me something, and he said, we all should be dead. And he was joking around, but that's the truth. We all should be dead. You know, in human history, we're the luckiest people in the world. That program at Hyman. And just for a second, I think, what would I be like? I don't care if you think this. I think it helps. What would I be like if there wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous? Would I be 53 years old? I mean, I got here at 30. I'm 22 years sober. And what would I be like? What would be happening with me? I don't know. I was so resistant. I went to therapy. That didn't work. I tried church. That didn't click. I tried working out to the gates of insanity and hell. You know, I had meditation, and Matt, my friend down here, got his legs crossed, and I see this inspirational tattoo on his cap that says, see you in hell, my friend. That really fired me up. But it's kind of true, though. If you're anything like me, an alcoholic of my type, and I really like to say my type, I mean, that's the only place people like me end up. I mean, there's no way. If there's function of the universe, any good and evil, I would be definitely cast to the dark side when I pass, whatever that is. Anyway, I want to get my story done because I spoke a few weeks ago. Larry called me this afternoon. I apologize for the people. I spoke a couple weeks ago in a meeting out on 3rd Street, a really nice meeting. And I thought about that right after he hung up the phone. And I thought about calling him back. I didn't have his number, but then I thought again. I go, well, yeah, but Miles, you really like to speak, so who cares if they heard you before? that's part of my thinking. It would be less than honest for me not to tell you all my thoughts here. See, I'm an alcoholic. I have many thoughts. I have a lot of committees up there all debating and arguing all the time and just working their numbers. And, you know, it's all about me and pleasure and comfort and me, me, me. And AA's just taught me how to put that in the back burner. Because that thinking and reacting on those thoughts always gets me alone and afraid and full of resentments and just not enjoying life. You know, this AA is the only way I've found to really give me the power to do things and give back to life, to get the feeling I crave. The feeling I found from Frank and Bill Huntington, I've got to love you. It's much more important than I think of you. The worse I feel, the more I need to love you and be kind to you and give to you and make you, because I want that back. Frank said this, you know, they say in the reading, the meditation the other day, he said unconditional love. And Frank is a very honest man, and he said, Miles, everything he did had a hook in it. Everything he did had a hook in it. Everything he did, he wanted something back. We, you know, it's okay, and then one of the reasons I had it, it's okay to be spiritually selfish. And I found this out, the true truth in life, the truth for me. I was always looking for truth, period. Truth, that's it. Put out love, forgiveness, harmony, truth, hope, faith, light, until I get it back. If I don't, I don't. That's all I do. I'm 22 years. I've 22 years of doing this. All I have to do is take my inventory over the last 2 weeks if I start feeling bad and think, yeah, but look what you've been doing. Appearance-wise, I'm going to 8 or 9 meetings. I'm working. I'm doing all these things. But have I gone out of my way? Have I worked that spiritual muscle? Have I stopped to talk to my neighbor? Have I done any extra work? Mike's got Clayton here. Have I picked the kid up and given him some love? Just little tiny things. I don't know. That I was, what am I not doing that I was doing when I was feeling good? You know, diet is very important to me. Exercise, sleep, you know, those basic things. Dan knows, we know, you know, I can be doing all good things, but if I'm eating crappy, I just feel crappy. And I never want to look at that. I want to say, no, it's got to be something deep and more intellectual, and maybe I'm from an alcoholic home. No. You've eaten too much ice cream. That's all it is. And I don't want to face the truth. I want to say, no, I want to eat ice cream and feel good. But large amounts until I pass out. The spoon and carton might make it back to the refrigerator off the floor, but it's usually just passed out next to me there. And anyway, I was born and raised in Long Beach. I'm the youngest of 3 children. I was right here, stone's throw away, born and raised right here. Slept in this park here years later. And I love Seaside Steve's story. I was thinking about that all week after he shared. There's a freedom waking up in the bushes. I know people are pretty calling you for favors. Nobody's future to the side. And I'd go back there tomorrow. But I was half dead. And, man, it's nowhere unless you're high, you know. So anyway, I was born right here. I'm the youngest of 3 children. You know, I was a spoiled brat. We weren't rich in anything, but I look back today, I was spoiled to death. My dad would come in to give us a beating. My dad was brought up on a farm, and he'd come in to give us a beating. You know, he was brought up in a 2-room house, 5 kids, money. They brought his mom, he loved his mom death. She'd go out the tree and get a big switch off that tree and pound your butt. So my dad would get the belt out and come in to whip my brother and I. We had these twin brothers, and he'd go to my brother first. He was the oldest, right? So he'd come in there and start flashing away at him, and Bruce would, oh, and I was looking at this. I got to look at this guy being annihilated, and I'm laying there in the bed next to him, and I am screaming so loud and so hard. I'm trying to get the neighbors awake, and finally he comes over and he just goes, hits me a couple times. He goes, shut up, brother. Would always kid about that because he got a worse beating all the time. And I was just, you know, my dad was a really good man, though, and we brought up an alcoholic home. One of those homes, you know what I mean, where find the bottle every night. You know, it wasn't a bad deal. My dad was great. He coached our Little League teams, took us to Catalina every summer, and the mom was skiing, and my mom was a chronic alcoholic. You know, it was when she wasn't drunk, she was dry. And, you know, women and men, you know, the vanity sets in. When she wasn't drunk, she was like me. She's a total commodity. And she said, I'd rather be drunk than fat, you know, and we all relate to that. You know, many people, when they get sober, I tell you, it takes time for this all to work out. And that's why I want to digress a minute. Thank God for meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're having trouble and your life isn't turning out the way you want, you get sober and you have a lot of other issues coming up, especially food and weight, man, just keep coming to these meetings. Something happened spiritually. I went to OA. I failed OA. I'm 22 years sober. And my body started to straighten out eventually. And it was the spiritual influence room going on every night. The only thing you got going for you is 3 quarts of ice cream sitting in the refrigerator. I mean, if you're like, and just survive. Just stay sober. Staying sober is so important. I don't care what you have to do. I don't care if you don't work a step, don't call anybody. If you have to hole up all day, put the covers over your head. We have a lady in our meeting, Mindy. She'd go to bed at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock at night. People go, well, you're avoiding reality. She'd say, no, I'm avoiding reality. I'm staying sober. And she had to do that for a long time just to stay sober. Whatever it takes, staying sober. If you're going to one meeting and you're staying sober, you're a winner today. That was the only criteria. You go to a meeting today, you didn't drink today, you're a winner today. Get in that winner circle, you know. And I thought, well, I got to do something more. I got to work these steps. I got to do those steps. You know what? Sometimes I was incapable of doing anything but just not drinking and going to a meeting. And it's hard as heck to go to a meeting when your head's on fire and you're isolated all day and all these people are smiling and laughing. And you just feel like, oh, you want to crawl under the floor. You just sit there and grit it out. And your higher power, in my experience, I'm as incapable of working steps or talking to people some days. I just go to that meeting and sit down. And I was miserable. And I couldn't wait for the meeting to be over, so I'd go home and isolate some more. And I thought I'm worse now than when I was new. I'm getting ahead of myself, but I realized AA still worked for me in spite of myself. In spite of myself. This program works in spite of us. But I was born, I'm going to get into that in recovery, but I was in that family, and my mom was crazy, and I had many experiences growing up. And, you know, my mom was always being drunk or off-center, and, you know, it was a good deal since you're the man of the house. You know, that's the alcoholic home. The kids become the parents. And my dad would pull in every night at 5 o'clock in the driveway from L.A. He'd work up in L.A. and that cone of silence would fall over the house. Never get smart. And all of a sudden it was like we'd go and sit in our bedrooms and wait for that first brick to be thrown, because he'd come and he's like the hungry bear coming home. He'd go, ah! And there, you know, my mom, the dinner was... She'd never get the dinner right. It would be uncooked, overcooked, no vegetables, nothing. And she'd be to the gills and act like he's not going to know for the 4,700th time. No, I haven't been drinking. No, Clinton. I still fear at the stove just going, you know. I mean, vivid memories of my mom, just this 5'1", like Betty Boop. denial, alcoholic. And then he got to the point, we moved to this other little house, right? And it was right in Los Altos, and we begged my dad. My dad was such a good man. He spent all his kids. He used to pay the bills, get all the groceries, and some weeks just have change in his pocket, just get the gas bill and everything. So we had this pool, and eventually we moved to that house, and by this time we're in junior high school, and they're really getting into it. My mom's getting out of control some nights, because alcoholics, we need attention, you know. My dad would come out, and he'd just learn how to work his Al-Anon program. He'd sit out and lay in front of the TV, and we'd sit there and watch TV, and my mom would come out, because we're not paying any attention to her. She'd come out and get between my dad and the television and try and get him to get mad at her. And my dad liked to drink milk. So her biggest thing would be, and say, Clinton, here, drink your milk, your high fat, your big fat, drink your milk. Because she didn't drink milk. She's an alcoholic, right? So this would go on, and my dad, some nights he'd sit and wait her out, and other nights he just couldn't wait her out. He'd have to get up and try and gently move her out of the room. And as soon as he got close to her, she'd scream, you're hitting me, you're beating me, oh, he's hitting me, children, please don't let him hit me, oh. He'd go, Mom, shut up, he's just trying to get you out of the room, you know. And then it got to the point where some nights he'd pick her up in the summertime, of course, take her to really tear her off. You know, out of the pool, wringing wet. You know, I just still see her, just this woman, wringing wet, just looking at, all right, Clinton, now you've really had it. You know what I mean? And, you know, we had scenes, breaking windows, and all this stuff. So that was what was going on. What was going on with me was me. You know, I was just all about me, thinking about me all the time. I was a dreamer, just dreaming, thinking. But I was popular. I was okay in elementary school, you know, president of sixth grade. I had some issues, you know, I was in fourth grade, and this is my big, big, changed my life. And my best friend Larry Down, and I told him I was going to ask this girl to go study. Long story short, Larry, before the end of the day, asked her to go study himself. Now, this is my best friend, right? Cool guy. He has a lawnmower shop, his dad, with go-karts behind him. We go over there and ride out. And I was wiped out. I never felt this bad. I guess I was fourth grade. I was old enough to really feel all those feelings and pre-alcoholic, whatever you want to call it. I don't know if I was born one or not. I'm not going to get into that issue. I know Larry, and I thought, oh my God, with trembling voice, I said, I've got to talk to you the next recess. And I looked at Sherry, and we gave each other a little St. Christopher's, and Sherry just held up her St. Christopher with this big, beautiful smile with this gorgeous little girl, and she goes, yes, Larry gave this to me. And I was wiped out, and I took Larry in this little bathroom at the last recess of the day, and I didn't know what I was going to do. So this is my MO. When the heat is on, on and in big trouble and pain. I started sobbing and crying so long and hard, he broke up with her, so I got today on the inside. The best example of the kind of person I am is the Wizard of Oz, and we've all seen it. I'm like the lion. I'm old bravado until you smack me in the nose, and oh, God, why did you have to do that to me? And, yeah, I can remember that, because every now and then I forget. I'm an alcoholic. I got alcoholism. I'm extraordinarily sensitive. Sometimes I'm callous and cold as a rock, but other times I'm just so sensitive. You look at me wrong, and I think you don't like me. I don't even know you, but you don't like me. And I was brought up in that deal, and I went to junior high school, and then everything happened. Junior high school, I won't get into it in detail, but it's true. Having those first, I had tremendous sexual problems in junior high school. I wasn't having sex with anybody but myself, but it was a huge problem. It was serious. I'm not talking about just kind of a minor issue. I'm talking about serious problems. Some of you guys relate to that. And, because you know why I had a problem with it? What? Because it felt too good, right? I had a serious problem with it. And to the point, I'm never going to have kids because that's going to be done with. So I figured that out. I'm in junior high school. I'm going to the library to look this up. I can't ask my friends. So I'm going to the library, an eighth grade kid going to the library trying to look this up. Because, I was worried. And I'm nervous and shy. This makes me really insecure. We had PE in junior high school, and I was one of those guys with a very late puberty. And some of you people know that have young, nubile body to another human being. You're just so inadequate to the measurements and everything. So I couldn't stand PE. I literally would love it when we didn't have to suit up. I didn't. I try not even take a shower because I was so embarrassed. I mean, it was such a. I mean, these were huge. I mean, my brain was on fire. Sexual problems, PE. Then I can't talk to girls anymore. I had a girlfriend in sixth grade. Now I can't talk to girls anymore. I'm just fading away. And they had this club called Salians. I didn't get off top for Salians. And some tough, cool, wild guy. He had no curfew in junior high school. I envied him. Today I know he has terrible parents. He was a messed up kid. But he was cool in junior high school. You know, the kids in junior high school are super cool. They're mostly dead right now or crazy, you know. And so I went over to his house. His mom had that warm beer in his kitchen sink. I was in Pabst Blue Ribbon or something, tall cans, and we rode the Stingray bikes with the high handlebars. You know, I was on the handles with him in one of those little parks, the park right down the street here, Stearns Park. And we drank that beer. I choked it down. Why? I just cigarettes. I wasn't able to smoke them, but I had to smoke them because all my friends were smoking them. The Carringtons, that was a big, I'm 53, you know, so that was a big cigarette then, we call them Carringtons. And I'd hold the smoke in my mouth, like that president, you know, and just blow it out, right? I wouldn't be able to inhale, but I had to smoke, and I desperately didn't want anybody to see that I wasn't inhaling, because I couldn't inhale, I was too wimpy, you know. And so I had this beer in the park, just enough for my life to change forever. The guy sitting in that park. I was rocked, I just was beyond words. Only people in this room know that feeling. Nirvana, ecstasy, euphoria. I was sitting with Greg, and all of a sudden, whew, I felt like Greg looked. I was cool. There were no girls there, but I knew immediately I could dance and sing. I could talk to girls. I just felt like I just came alive inside. And I just looked at Greg, and I took that Carrington, and I took a big hit off and inhaled all the way deep down and blew that smoke out, and I just felt like John Wayne and Clint Eastwood, those guys in the movie. I just sat there with Greg in that park and that magic, and we didn't drink too much, went home the next day, and of course we drank every chance we could after that. And the next time I drank cold 45 malt liquor, you know what happened? One tall can, that magic, two, incredible ice, three, it was, I can't, you know, what, 3.5, boom, barfing all night, all day, all night, all day, all the bile's barfed out. That started the pattern of my drinking. They fast forward 15 years. I would drink to a point, this is the time, then I can never, couldn't even stand the taste of it. I get revoltingly ill. I'm the kind of drunk, when I pass out somewhere, I don't puke a little while and go back and drink some more. I puke, I'm sick as a dog, I'm deathly ill, and if you move me, I will kill you. Don't touch me. If I move one inch, I'll start violently retching again, so I don't care if I'm laying in the park with my head in puke. Don't move me. Don't move me. The only way to get well is to be perfectly still, right? And so I never drink beer again, and then I ran into vodka. Great drink. Vodka and orange juice. And we sit in the front of orange juice, and my dad would be back in the bedroom. My mom would be buying her booze for us. We'd sit out there with our half pints between our legs, act like we're playing. a little splash of vodka and about, 16 ounces of orange juice because I couldn't stand the taste of the alcohol. I was so afraid of getting sick, and I learned how to drink vodka and orange juice. That was awesome. I went from a pint to a half pint to almost a pint, puked my guts out violently over a three-month period of what you're drinking once a week, could never drink vodka anymore. Couldn't even stand the taste, the smell of it, but I tried it. Vodka and lemonade, very short-lived, and vodka Delaware Punch, even short on my system. I love Tom W. It's a fresh alcohol. I got to get alcohol on my system somehow. Now I'm in high school. Valley High. Found Valley High. It was good. That lasted about 2 or 3 months. Got really sick on Valley High. Then for some reason, I was able to segue into Sinatra for a little while. Got sick on that. Now I'm done. I can't drink wine. I can't drink alcohol. I can't. So I'm with some friends, and they bought a keg. A little pony keg. Remember those? And nothing's like that fresh beer. Remember those fresh beer? And it just was so fresh, I kind of got past the taste of it. And I choked up, because in my high school, I was at Wilson High School, 7 to 70. The coolest guys could sit down and drink a six-pack of beer. You were on. You were there. And we'd drive around in our car, when you throw a beer out the window, you'd listen. We'd turn the radio down real quick to make sure it gave a clink instead of a clunk. Because the biggest thing, to drink the beer was essential. If you had a clunk, you were faking it. You know what I mean? Your machoism was decided you could drink 6 or 8 beers or 2 six-packs. You were like king, So I learned how to drink beer, and I from my junior in high school on, every Friday and Saturday, every Friday I had to drink beer from the beginning of the evening, 2 o'clock in the morning, we go face down and Jack in the Box at Taco Bell. You know what I mean? Crash out, little hangover, but learned how to nurse it, and beer was like my IV drip. Unless I had a beer in my hand, I almost felt sober. As soon as I put a beer down, if you don't have a cold one or a beer around, you start to get a little insecure and nervous. So I'd have that beer in my hand all night long, and then start doing on weekends sometimes. My best friend in high school, his girlfriend would say, "Miles, why do you always have to have a beer in your hand? We play softball." I go, "We got to get some beer. We got to get some beer." And I thought, just like all you guys, my God. And he got rid of that girlfriend because he'd gotten in the way of our drinking and having fun. And I got to played water polo and got scholarships. Well, I went to Long Beach City College and played real well with Monty Niskowski, great coach, great teacher, Barbara Talbot there. And let me see what time it is. 8 o'clock. I know people don't want to hear what time it is because you're hoping it'll be later if you get out earlier. Now you're frozen. If you're like me, you're thinking, God, it's only 8 o'clock. I got to sit another 25 minutes, and this guy's driving me crazy. Okay, think of me. I got to live with myself. I went to City College, played with Monty. It was great. 2 great years. We won state championships, got honors and all that stuff, but drinking every Friday and Saturday night. Every Friday and Saturday night, I got recruited to Cal to play water polo. Played there 2 years. We won national championships. Got to play at the Belmont Plaza Olympic Pool before family and friends, got honors. So I had all this going on, and the drinking was there. Boom, boom, boom. Drinking was fun. Fun was drinking. I couldn't go out and have fun just not drinking. Any social occasion, I'd have that alcohol in my system and have fun. Got out of Cal, came to Long Beach State, got my teacher credential, got into cocaine, but I didn't learn about cocaine. It's just like a Rusty F says, freeze-dried alcohol. But I did that line of cocaine, and I went and take a shower, and we played these water polo games that day. We had 3 games played the next day, and we had this line, and I went in the shower, and this thing went through my central nervous system and exploded. And I was feeling better than alcohol. I couldn't believe it. Now, this internal warning system said inside my body, very clear, it said, "Miles, I tried to stop doing that because I felt I loved you too much. I made such a fool of myself. When I'm high and I'm cocaine, I tell you, I don't care who you are. I love you. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. I don't care if you're man, woman, dog, animal. You and I are going to travel the world. We're inseparable forever." It was like I was way out there. And I was so humiliated the next day. It's bad enough drinking, but, oh, man. You just tell the activities director, because I wouldn't shut up, and or higher. And I yet the next day, the humiliation, the shame, and it coming down, and it started to take away from my physical fitness and my health, because I was proud of myself. You can pound beer and play water polo hard, but this was taking away this. I was staying up all night, and had to play 3 water polo games the next day, and I started to square off that forever. And then my life changed forever from that moment on. About 24 to 30, I went through these. I started to be a spree drinker, a binge drinker, because I'd drink and do drugs, and I'd be out of money after 2 hours, then scrape the weekend to borrow, beg, and steal. So that, my life became just a living hell. I'd get dry, and I'd work out for 4 to 6 weeks. I chased the physical fitness and the gates of insanity death. I got myself in such physical shape that I have to work out 2 times a day just to keep away from, I get too nervous, I couldn't sit still. So when I was drinking and using, I'd be working out. That was my only advantage. tied up into that. And one time I tried to gain weight and lose, gain muscular strength and lose weight, you know, getting one of those washboard stomachs and one of those physical fitness guys. Think anorexic 150, eating raw garlic and lecithin and carrot pulp. But I'm looking, you know, I'm looking at myself in the mirror constantly, and I'm going, but you're looking good. I start turning white, and I got an internal blockage, all in a vain attempt to try and live a life without drinking and using, you know. And I know what anorexia is now. I was looking at myself. I looked better the thinner I got. And my parents and friends are going, you look terrible. You're turning white. Eat, eat. You're melting away, you know. So I know this disease for me takes all forms and shapes. You know, Jerry M. From Belfast, Jerry's great. He said, it's all under the big top, this alcoholism. You know, some people have the gambling, the sex, the spending. You know, it's all under this food thing is insidious because we got to, you know, anything that gives us pleasure, we have trouble with sometimes. So the biggest event in my life, and it changed my life forever. I was 27 years old and went to a wedding. Jeff Burrows, great ball player and friend of ours in Long Beach. My brother, he grew up with us, and his son Sean's playing for the Padres. So it was a big event, you know. And at the end of it, I'd done 6 weeks again. My usual pattern was 6 weeks away. Anybody go a month to 6 weeks? I run a marathon, do a 10K. No way. My mom is. I don't use for a month to 6 weeks at a time. It's been going on for 5 years now, but still. And I went to this wedding at the end of the night. I wasn't going to drink. I wasn't going to use, but I'm an alcoholic, and I got alcoholism. I don't even know it. I'm the wrong people doing the wrong thing in the wrong place. I don't know. I'm powerless. I don't know. I got to drink like I have to take my next breath. Sure, at the end of the night, that thinking comes in, the alcoholic thinking. I say, I deserve a drink, and I take a beer, and my heart soars as the all-night for me to get some a quart of beer, a case of beer and a quart of tequila. So I went back to his house. We had a line and a beer, and I just got started, and we ran down to get the liquor store at 10 to 2, and I'm driving back through Naples. And I didn't see this guy. I went through the intersection, but I'm not paying attention because, you know, I'm talking. I got to talk. And Mike, who's sitting next to me, who's a drug dealer, yells at me, Miles. And this guy's walking right in front of me, and I don't see him, and I can't even hit the brakes, and I just slam into him, and we pulled the car over. Well, about maybe 150 yards or something past the signal. He was jaywalking out of the old Diver's Cove at the Crow's Nest now or something. And I pulled the car over, and we walked back, and we stood in a circle around this body laying in the street. And I had a tuxedo on with my hair all flipped back, being the Great Gatsby. That was my image that night. And I looked at this guy, and alcohol was telling me, what a bummer. We want to party. I don't care about this. Let's party, party, party. Alcohol was telling me, man, this is no good. I don't care. We'll deal with it tomorrow. People, and this guy goes, anybody see who hit him? And this one guy goes, oh, some big car hit him and took off. Immediately just walked out of that circle and went around the corner, and Mike went back and he said, the ambulance here, there's nothing you can do. So we went, got in his car and drove to his house and partied with a vengeance all night. And I stop at this point because many people in this room, I'm sure, had that night or that event in their life when they did something horrible, their family, a friend, or loved one, or used and used to get out of their head. And I did all night, as long as I could. So, of course, I always run out of money and people to use. That's my story. I run out of money and people to use, and I had to come to the next afternoon, and we got an attorney and just handled it all out of court. The attorney met with the police. He turned me in to them, and I said I was too distraught to stay at the scene. I lied. He was blood alcohol over the legal limit. He was jaywalking. So it got all handled. But the guilt was there. The house right over here. And that became my ace in the hole. The last 7 years or 5 years of my life, I'd go to my grandma's house when I was down, and I had no money, no place to live, and she'd take me in again and again and again. That poor woman, God bless her. And I did it like any alcoholic. I was so depressed. Drinking didn't wasn't an option. I ate around the clock, and I slept for 2 weeks straight, just avoiding reality. And then I muddled on with my life. That was 3 years before I got sober. So fast forward 3 years. All kinds of stories between those next 3 years. My dad bought me a swimming pool business. I drank right into the ground. So I'm at my granny's house. I'm finally turning 30 years old. What am I going to do with my life? And finally, I caught a break. I always liked to work out. I ran into this girl who taught aerobics, and I started taking aerobic classes back then. A lot of men were starting to take them. When it was Jane Fonda with this girl, and we learned all the workouts. She became my girlfriend, and I started teaching aerobic exercise for a living. And I taught in Belmont Racquetball Club, Toledo, NATO, Bayshore Congressional Church, Community Memorial Hospital, the nurses. I had my life. I finally found a life. It was and then about I'm running the Long Beach Marathon, not even working out, advertising my workouts, so I take on more workouts, more exercise, right? I think, what is wrong? I'm trying more sex. I'm trying anything I could. Half my body's going, eat, flaw, gluttony. Half my body's going, what's wrong with me? What's my problem? Well, now we're in aerobic competitions. I teach the competitions. I'm competing with these other aerobic instructors. We finish our performance, and people are just going, nice job, good, march me down 2nd Street and go, hail Caesar, Miles, you are the king. I felt this, you know, when you do something, you teach your heart, and you feel it's going to change your life, and people go, yeah, that's real good. Real good, Matt. Thank you very much. See ya. So I just, and I had this thing inside. I didn't know it was alcohol. It was this dark hole. So three and a half months in, I didn't know what my problem was. I said, I couldn't stand the way I thought and felt. Every day, that spring, like Clancy says, was getting tighter in my stomach. Tighter, tighter, tighter. Now, a car, a 10-year-old Volvo, was like a new car for me. I got money in the bank. I'm meeting with the Dixie Ranch people with a doctor. His wife is taking my aerobic class. He's a doctor at Memorial, one of the foremost cardiologists there, was in on the bypass, that heart bubble thing. And we're meeting with Dixie Ranch. I'm sitting down. He goes, what kind of salary you want? He wants me to teach aerobics while he does the cardio. And we're sitting with the Dixie Ranch people right down here by Marine Pacifica. I'm sitting in those rooms with those people. Now, remember that feeling. You're sitting with people, and you have that feeling in your life with alcohol. You can't imagine your life without it. I'm sitting in those rooms, and I had this feeling of intense impending doom, and I felt like telling these people, hey, time out. Can I freeze-frame life like Twilight Zone? Can you all sit here, and can I go over here for a couple weeks and just sit in front of the TV and figure things out? I mean, life is moving. You can't tell everybody, hey, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't know what I want to do. I thought I want to teach aerobics. I don't think I do, but I don't know what else I want to do, and I can't not teach aerobics. I can't brainstorm. I go, I need a vacation. That was it. I mean, it was a brainstorm. I thought, wow, I've been working 3.5 months. Normal people take vacations. So I took this girl to Palm Springs. I thought that would be the answer. We get to Palm Springs. On the way to stop at Hadley's, gets a little deal going. We're in Palm Springs. I swear, this is the true version. We're cruising to Palm Springs. I'm feeling worse than when I left Long Beach. This feeling has now moved into the terror zone. I'm an apple. Miserable. My life has never been better. This beautiful girl, we're in Palm Springs. I am absolutely out of my mind. We go to this beautiful timesharing unit. I'm in there with this girl looking at her, and thank God she came with me because I was able to identify the problem. And you know what the problem was? That girl. Of course, that girl. And just like a big brain, just goes, wow, it's the girl. Oh, I'll suffer through 2 days with her, and every girl around looks better than your girl. You know what I mean? I don't care if they look better or not, you know, whatever you need, right? So, anyway, I didn't know this was alcoholism. I didn't know I was out of my mind. This beautiful girl had done nothing wrong. So I get back to Long Beach. I took the vacation. I'm ready to break up. We pull in the driveway, and I said, Janet, I don't know what's wrong. Now, how many of you guys use this line? This is really unique. I don't know what's wrong. Maybe we need a little break. That's real classic, right? It means, could you wait in this closet for like 2 weeks or so? I want to go out on an adventure with life, and if I can't find anything better, I'll be back. But, you know, and turned around, got in this little blue Volkswagen, drove around the corner, and my guts fell on the street. As soon as that car went around the corner, I was like, come back! And then my head exploded. I was totally gone. Best shave of my life, sitting there in the middle of the street. I went in the house. I thought, talk about gut churning. I said, my last great thought was, I'm going to sit in a chair. And I teach aerobics at 4:30 to 3:30 in the afternoon. At the end of that hour, I like that guy in the sandwich shop when he has a glass of milk, and he said, just a little whiskey in this milk. Remember in the big book it talks about that. At the end of the hour, that thought came through like a butterfly. Not like an anvil, not like a hammer, not like a friggin' explosive. It said, just a couple beers, just a night of relief, just a little relief. That's how my ism talks to me. It's sweet, it's kind, it's gentle. It says, come with me. And it doesn't show the side of the railroad tracks and run you over. Come with me. And I just thought, and in the back of my mind, I know I can't do this. I kept saying, shut up, shut up, shut up. But I reached that turning point we all get to. I literally couldn't imagine my life with it without it to the nth degree. And I went out for just one night of relief. And I knew even when I was going to do it, but maybe it'll be different. and I started drinking and using right then. And man, as soon as I started that stuff, you know, first thing I did was coke. God, I thought, oh, it's like a guy, you hold him underwater till he's just about to die and you let him up for a breath. That's how I felt. It's just, oh, I breathed again. I drank that beer. Oh. I never not want to feel this way again. And my mind goes, Miles, you can't live this way. You have everything. Shut up. Anything I put in my system, shut up. And I started that shut up thing. Shut up. And it lasted for about Volvo Station Wagon, 10-speed bike, or Woodrow's bike riding around Belmont Shore. You know, I used everything and everybody else. The car, I think, was out of gas. I can't deal with it because I'm too high and people will ask me questions. I can't deal with the car. Leave it alone. Good. The bike was worth the money. First person who gave me money for it is gone. So now it's a 10-speed little girl's bike. Nobody really wants it. So I'm ripping around Belmont Shore. I'm like that witch in the Cyclone or the Wizard of Oz. And people are looking for me. I'm ripping off every single person. I'm looking through phone books for people I knew from elementary school. And I, thank God, I can't put it together. It's a total blackout, whiteout, you know, deal. I don't know where I slept or where I got money. I just did it. And I was moving, too. I wasn't laying around, man. I was moving all night long, man. And the last week or two, what happened was I stopped being able to turn my head off. And it was really scary. When I stone cold, I felt stone cold, sober in reality, doing coke and drinking and smoking. I just felt like clear. It was like, whoa. It's like watching a TV station that's out of it, and then every time it gets clear, then I got clear, then it became clear. Oh, and I nightmare, sober night, drunk, loaded nightmare. And I was sitting there, and I couldn't shut my head off. I ran out of people, and I just got so tired. I was sitting down at Bogart's. Bogart's where used to be in the Pacifica. Some of you know it. And I was always looking over my shoulder. I had a lot of people looking for me. One guy kept telling me, these guys are going to really hurt me. And you know, when you don't care when you're... And I sat there, and I called my sister. I don't know why I called my sister. She came and got me, took me to her house, and I'd been to her house and pillaged her kids' coins and stole from her and everything. She watched me like an escaped gorilla from the San Diego Zoo, and she called my dad over. My dad just digged, like, I'm sorry, he's a military, and if he walked in there, my dad could still kick my butt today. He's going to be 85 this year. And he walked in, he said, you're coming with me. And he took me to his house. Now, it's a one-bedroom condo on Ocean Boulevard. My mom's drinking around the clock. He took the ace in the hole away. He saved my life. Took the ace in the hole away at my grandma's house. So you're not going back there. And my brother had been telling him that for years. He put me on his bed. I passed out for 2 days. When I came to, he goes, we're going to get you help. Now, I'd been to A. I took my mom to A when I got out of college. I knew her. She was a good soul, man. Everybody loved my Mrs. E. They called her Mrs. E. She was a gal. But she was, you know, she's a bad mother. She's an alcoholic. But she's a party girl. And my dad looked at me and he said, okay, we're going to get help. And so we started looking for help and driving around these places. And I don't even remember the name. I think they were called treatment centers. But I'm not an alcoholic. Cocaine was non-addicting. 1982, Medical Association said so. So we're driving around looking for these places up in L.A. They're really seedy places. Oh, Lord, Betty Ford didn't exist yet. So we don't know what to do. And he's driving me to this one place, and I go, Dad, please don't put me in there. You know what I mean? And we drove home, and after 2 days looking, he was going to go take a day off for himself. And I'm on the couch at 10 o'clock in the morning. He's out the door at 10. He's probably back at 5. So I figured I had a day of sloth, gluttony and sloth. Now, drug dealers are calling the house, talking to my dad. My dad's afraid of no man. My uncle's a cop. He goes, come over here. Get this fucking, you know. And because it was serious, some of the money I owed him. You know, drug dealers, oh, they want their money, these guys, you know. So, anyway, on the couch, I'm laying there on the couch, and he's at the door, it's right over here, and I gave him one of those one eyes from the couch. I go, yeah, Dad. He goes, get up and get help. I go, yeah, Dad. And I said, well, my dad has always been there for me. My dad's the love of my life, and he's never not been there for me. He I'm sure he hated me, loathed me, but he loved me like a man. Any man could love a son more, I don't know. And he looked at me one more time, and he saved my life. And this is big, if you know my... And, man, I tell you, that I cried for my first 5 years every time I shared that. Because if you have the relationship with one person in your life who loves you more than anybody in the world, who will never turn their back and never, no matter what, and he threw me into the wolves, and he knew I had nowhere to go, and I was down and out. And I did like Al Rosenkrantz and any good alcoholic does. When he said that, electricity went through my body. I jumped off the couch. And I was terrified. This man who's done everything for, and I said, oh, whatever, Dad. And he found a place and said, we're going to take you on Monday. You can come in if you show up Monday. So I went, and we'll go take you for an interview. If you pass the interview, you get in. So that weekend, my girlfriend took me back in. So I spent the weekend drinking beer because I couldn't deal with my feelings. I didn't know what feelings were. I drank beer all weekend, and then Sunday morning I had a tall neck Budweiser, which was my drink of choice, and a wad of bubble gum on the nightstand. I woke up with her, and I took the gum and popped it in my mouth and took a hit off that Budweiser, and she looked at me and she goes, are you going to do that again today? I looked at her in the grave, what does it matter? And I put the beer down and the wad of gum, spit it out, and I said, whatever. And the next day I went to Impact Recovery House, and, you know, we only newcomers and people who, everybody in this room remembers their first day. I mean, my God, but let us not forget that. The only thing worse than drinking is not drinking, for me, that's my story. I hit a man in accident, it doesn't matter, sobriety is nothing for me. I hit a man in accident, he died. I really don't care if I live or die. I did, but I didn't. You know, I had too chicken to kill myself and all that. People with morals and principles commit suicide. And they did a little interview, and I went out to stay. My dad, they're going to take me. And my dad, I was traveling, so I just, my dad looked at me and looked around that recovery house. And this was not a pretty place. It's still had dirt in the ground. There are people of all different ethnic auras. Didn't look like anybody intelligent was there. My dad's a very educated English major from Iowa. And he looked at that house, he looked at me, and he just broke down and started sobbing. Just sobbing. I mean, racked with tears. And I tell you, I'd like to say I broke my heart, but I had no heart left. My heart was as cold as a stone. Leave. I couldn't say anything. I couldn't say I'm sorry. I said that a billion times. I couldn't comfort. I couldn't put my arms around him. And I just thought, two out of three kids ain't bad. Just, what do you care? If you feel that bad, take me home. You know, set me up again. You know, that's those crappy thoughts we have. And he left, and they took me in. My intake counselor was Ed W. He's 18 years life, 18 years sober, 44, 18 years of his life in prison, 44 years sober. No, he was 44 years old, 18 years of life in prison, and 4 years sober. Now, this is a guy who's going to, and he's got tattoos up and down his arms like mad here. He's chain smoking caramel cigarettes and drinking coffee. And I'm thinking, I'm taking his inventory right away. You know how we are. You know, I'm a water polo player from Cal, of course. Don't you know? And he looks at me and goes, Miles, we didn't ask you to come here. Something like that. Because I told him right from the get-go, I said, you're not going to tell me anything I don't know. Because I've been around and I've been a counselor, and he said, we didn't ask you to come here pretty much. And he goes, this program is so, he goes, Miles, you're best here. Now, that was a silver bullet. It went right through me. I was ready to hear. Like Frank said, I ran that around my pea brain a couple times, and I could do nothing to dilute it. I could do nothing to think that away or put him down or somehow, you know, judge it. Because nobody ever said that to me. He said, Sue, we don't have time to straighten out your thinking here. Whoa. He's like two for two. I was going, how did he know I was such a deep thinker? You know? I mean, we alcoholics, we all just keep, and I got to remember, everybody in this room thinks the way I do. What's life all about? Why are we here? What's the purpose? Where are we going to go after we die? Are we really going to go in? You know, I can do that inside of half a second, you know. and then he said, Miles, this program is so simple. If I put a $20 bill on the wall, all you got to do is get out of your chair and grab it. And with that, he threw me in a meeting May 24th, 1982, at 9 o'clock in the morning. I've been to AA before. I didn't know this was AA. I didn't know it was AA. I didn't know the recovery house was a program at all. It's just a recovery house. From their stories. Tough, cool guys I wouldn't mix with ordinarily. You know, like Edward and I are talking about. I thought they wouldn't like me either. You know, 18 to 64, men and women in there, pretty roughly dressed. And I listened to their stories, and man, my heart took a skip to beat. And I thought, my God, I didn't know anybody did the things I did. And then later I got to realize I didn't know anybody felt the way I felt. I didn't know that. And then a room full of guys. If you're like me, the curtain came down. I was really upset. I demanded they call my father. He's on the way home. Call my dad. You ripped me off. You didn't tell us the religious program. And they insisted it wasn't a religious program. And they're saying the Lord's Prayer. Does that make sense? You're new. You tell me, right? So I sat there and I don't remember saying anything. And these guys came over. Guys in the group, men and women, men came over to me, men I didn't even know, treated me nice. Now, I'm an alcoholic. I didn't know I got tremendously low self-esteem to me. That made me feel really good, and I never want to forget.
we don't have an easier time with this God stuff either. And I got it from them. I couldn't have got it from a guy dressed up like me, but from another newcomer, it was really good. And they said, it's not a religious program, it's spiritual. And then the next guy comes up, he said, hey, Holmes, it's going to be all right. And so I had to straighten him out because he thought my last name was Holmes. So I said, my name's Miles Evans. Please get it right. So that became the joke. And then they took me to a meeting. I'm short on time. They took me to a meeting, and I literally fell in love with the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell in love with them. I loved them from the start because I had such low self-esteem. I had hit a man and killed a man in action. I really believe that my second meeting I went to when I walked out of that room, I never want to forget this. I really believe, the bottom of my heart, this is rigorous honesty, if you get to know me, you won't like me, I'm sure. Especially the things I've done, because the things are how people truly love me. I have to carry that around like an albatross in a weight. And they have some kind of a lifeboat. I'll never be free of the guilt and fear and the shame. And these people, the more they heard about me, the more they love me. And I cry when I think about that. And that's what we have here. You know, Frank said is that we're lucky people in the world, the love we have for each other. I mean, it's so insane to think of. I always think about this. We're not perfect people. We're born in the world. We've all done terrible things. I shouldn't be preaching, but I just think, it's just, I made some mistakes. I would have taken back to that guy. Hey, if that's what it took, and it came to the crossroads, and I had faith, I believe I would, But the counselor in the recovery house, the counselor, the guy was a few months sober, he said, put yourself in that man's place who you killed. Put yourself in his place. You're dead, you're gone, he's here. Now what do you want? Come from your heart. Think what you want for him. What do you want? Do you want to take the life? And that came really clear to me. You know what I mean? And so, that's it. I get to do this. No problem to me. I know why I go to meetings. I know I'm here. I can never get back what's been given me. My only guilt is I don't do enough and give enough to people. Truly, I'm an alcoholic. I never feel like I can give enough. Only when I'm up to my teeth with people do I feel okay. And as soon as I back off, and Frank Hunnicutt gave me that. Frank was a real alcoholic. He didn't feel good unless he was helping people and doing things for other people. And then I read in Chuck Chamberlain's book. When he passed away, they published a book that said, Chuck, what about self-love? What about self-love? And Chuck says, and if you're new, this guy had been sober and helped more read about him than anybody who's been around, Steve read over him. He helped more people, and he said, alcoholics have one thing in common, all of them, pilots, whatever, low self-esteem. Low self-esteem. It's not something that goes away. We just got it. And every day we work on that. And he said, the only time, at the end of his life, they go, Chuck, what about self-love? He goes, I wouldn't take me with a large dowry. He said, I don't think of myself anymore in a large walrus. This is the guru of AA. And he said, the only time I feel good about myself is when I'm doing things for other people. Then I don't feel good like these other people. They seem to be skipping through the tulips and moving on with life. As soon as I slow down, I get sick and depressed and crazy. Then I find out I'm a real alcoholic, an alcoholic of my type. And Frank and Bill Hunnicutt got me involved in service. Thank God for Frank. And he taught me the sickest people in this program, and I'll say this, sit down, the sickest people in this program continue to study themselves and get better. It doesn't mean don't work the steps and take it in, or don't read anything into that other than I need to do way more action than analysis. Analysis for me leads to paralysis. I just never do it right, especially alone. But my mom died at 6 months sober, and I on her hospital bed, we tried to get her sober. I took her to the round table, and the people there loved me, and it helped me a lot. And they tried to love my mother, but she didn't get it. And on her deathbed, she was going in and out of coma. We got her in the hospital for 6 weeks. They tried to get her liver and kidney work, and they couldn't. Six weeks without a drink, she died. And the last thing she said to me, I went to her bedside, and she came out of the coma white as a ghost, and she was scared to death. She was on death's door, and she took my hand, and she said, Milesy, when I get out of here, I'm going to go to those meetings. And then she passed away. So keep coming back. Thank you.